40 million people participated in Arba'in pilgrimage in 2016, and the number keeps growing every year. These people mainly walk the whole 45 miles from the city of Najaf to the city of Karbala, and on their way, the pilgrims are served with not only food, shelter, and water, but are even provided medical services and security.
The War of Karbala, where Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon them, who stood up against a tyrannical ruler, Yazid ibn Muawiyah, is believed to transcend all cultural boundaries and be a symbol of universal freedom, compassion, and social justice. The struggle of Imam Hussein and his companions against injustice and their sacrifice in Karbala is not only an example of humanity at its best, but represents a chance for the diverse people of the subcontinent to unite and come together in a struggle for justice.
The people of the subcontinent religiously participate in the holy activities of Muharram, including the Ashura processions. Those who cannot go directly to Karbala participate in local processions, which happen all across the globe on the 10th of Muharram and 40 days after. These huge rallies include hundreds of thousands of people at any one time, and even millions in some instances. In India, although most processions are allowed, some of the main Muharram processions have been banned by the government since 1989. But believers prepare for the ritual every year nonetheless. In Indian-controlled Kashmir, the processions are often attacked by the Indian police, as Kashmiris often use Muharram processions as an inspiration to protest against the oppression perpetrated by the Indian government. In Pakistan, Muslims organize and participate in processions, but the threat of attacks from extremists looms over the faithful. Therefore, the processions are held under tight security. This is because of bomb blasts and suicide attacks that mark Pakistani Shia gatherings every year. And although the attacks have decreased, it is estimated that in Pakistan, over 23,000 Shia Muslims have been killed since 1963. The killings were once so rampant that some researchers describe it as genocide.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Sayyid Salman Naghavi. He's an Islamic scholar from Pakistan, currently residing in Rome. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Naghavi. Now, the story of Karbala brings people of diverse faiths together against injustice. Now, how do you think this can unite minorities of India against injustice, seeing that the sacrifice of Imam Hussein and his companions in Karbala is mourned not just by Muslims, but by Hindus and Christians as well?
Yes, in the name of Allah, the Supreme Absolute Being, the message of Muhammad alayhi salam is Islam. It has a global appeal because the mission of Imam Hussein was to stand up against injustice and tyranny and corruption. And basically, the underpinning ideology of Imam Hussein's movement was based on the fact that he was fighting for the cause of mankind and for providing it competent and worthy leadership. And therefore, the issue that all of mankind faces today is the imposition of the hegemonic rule of people who are not competent, not worthy. They are deprived of basic moral values and principles. And they want to create a world order in which they are at the head of and at the head of all the affairs of the of mankind, and wherever we have injustice and wherever we have tyranny, where we the Muslims or mankind in general faces oppression at the hands of people who are not worthy of ruling other people, they are not competent. They do not have moral and ideological beliefs which can make them serve mankind for the sake of mankind. We have a problem, and that is why Imam Hussein stood up against that corrupt regime.
Mr. Naghavi, the Arba'in processions have been held worldwide on a massive scale, but why is the media coverage so limited or non-existent in some outlets?
Yes, I think that because the global hegemony in the media is of these Zionists, and they do not want us to lay the groundwork for a movement against that hegemonistic oppression that they are perpetrating all over the world. So they would not like us, like the world, to understand that such a movement is growing day by day, every year. You look, the Pakistanis coming from Pakistan, they are increasing every year. The biggest movement of mankind, Pakistanis, subcontinent people, they are becoming a part of it, despite the floods, despite so many problems that the Pakistanis are facing. Just because of that, now, those who are oppressing us, they are perpetrating that tyrannical global hegemony. They don't want people of the world to realize that such an awakening is being created, which may turn against them. They may have issues which I think they need to cover up today. They need to hide this truth, that this may be a ritualistic movement today, but tomorrow it will turn up into a grand revolution against the oppressive regimes and the corrupt regimes of the world. Today, we in Pakistan or in the subcontinent are facing the consequences of global warming. And Pakistan or the subcontinent has a very small impact in that. 1% of the impact is from Pakistan, but it is facing 10% of the consequences, the calamities, the floods. This is because of the injustice which is taking place in the world. So this movement for Imam Hussein, it may be just a mourning ceremony for Imam Hussein and the Arba'een, but it will change into something global, universal, which has an appeal for the world. Today, even in the West, everyone there knows that 1% of the population is ruling over the 99%. So if they understand that Imam Hussein is calling us.
So Mr. Naqvi, why is it that the Indian or in Indian-controlled Kashmir, the Indian government meddles in the religious affairs of its Muslim population?
We all know that in Kashmir, the people of Kashmir, the Muslims of Kashmir, whether Shias or the Sunnis, they have been oppressed, they have been deprived of their rights, they want freedom from India, they want to be independent, or they want to have freedom from India. And for expressing that, the outpouring of their feelings can be channelized through the Muharram and the Arba'een movement. And any such movement which provides that ground and facilitates that expression of that political ideology and sentiment will certainly be, again, as we were talking about the media, the Indian occupied Kashmir or the Indian administered Kashmir, they will certainly not allow that to happen, because again, Imam Hussein will provide us the opportunity. He will provide the Kashmiris to channelize their aspirations for the sake of nationhood through Imam Hussein's movement. And that is something which is there for all of mankind. On one hand, we have the Palestinians on the western flank and the eastern flank. We have two oppressed, occupied nations. And till it was a nationalistic movement, we did not have success. They were not successful. Since it became an Islamic movement, and thereby, within the Islamic movement, the movement of Imam Hussein is given a central position, and our feelings and our ideology are channelized through this movement, it will certainly have its results.
Last but not least, sir, are mourners of Imam Hussein in Pakistan allowed to commemorate Imam Hussein's sacrifice freely and safely?
Actually, in Pakistan, the Shia community has been observing Muharram and Safar since the time it became independent from India and before that, as a ritualistic mourning every year it has been able to carry out this commemoration of Imam Hussein's martyrdom. It has been facilitated by the government, but all through the decades, or through the past decades, we have been facing problems at the hands of those who are who have been incited against the unity of the Ummah, against the Shias residing in Pakistan, at the hands of the stooges of Takfiris and those who have a Wahhabi ideology to stand up against the Shias. So they have been creating problems for Pakistanis, and they have influence in all the institutions, and they do create problems. They do create issues where, for example, over the last few years, FIRs have been registered against many people who are carrying out these ceremonies. But the problem again here, for example, the movement of the Pakistanis towards Iraq this year has been problematic. And again, the Pakistani authorities have not very much facilitated that. The Iraqi authorities have been providing excuses which cannot be accepted fully.
There you have it, Mr. Sayyed Salman Naghavi, Islamic scholar from Pakistan, currently residing in Rome. Thank you for being on the program, Mr. Naghavi. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Jaigar Malik says, "No caste, no religion, no nationality, no black and white, all are equal here. Yes, this is Karbala, Arbaeen Imam Hussein, the world's largest peaceful gathering." Aditya Menon says, "Not surprising that people say in Kashmir every day is Ashura and every town is Karbala." Michelle says, "Even non-Muslims come to visit Imam Hussein in Arbaeen. Have you thought to yourself why?"
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Russia is one of the most heavily sanctioned countries on earth right now, and Uncle Sam is trying to ensure that no one can help Russia during this time. However, India, which has close ties to the US, is still buying Russian oil at cheap prices.
Under the garb of Ukraine war, the United States and its allies in Europe and Asia quickly moved to impose unprecedented sanctions against the Russian economy. Among the measures they adopted include freezing nearly half of Russia's financial reserves, expelling a number of Russia's largest banks from the SWIFT payment system, and placing an embargo on Russian oil and coal. Not that this has worked, Russia has used sanctions as an opportunity to boost its self-reliance, as the country has offered cheap oil to the world and revenues continue to soar. Russia's current currency reserve surplus swelled to a record high of $167 billion between January and July, more than triple from a year earlier. India and China have been buying Russian crude against the wishes of the U.S. and its allies. To counter this, the U.S. is trying to bring the G7 countries, consisting of the U.K., U.S., Canada, France, Germany, Italy, and Japan, on board to cap Russian oil price, in the hope that Russian oil revenues can be restricted.
The G7 nations, led by the U.S., are trying to apply a price cap on Russian oil sales, and the European Union urged China and India to join the G7 initiative to apply a cap on Russian oil prices. However, China has not complied, and India has remained silent on the matter. The Indian Petroleum Minister Hardeep Singh told CNBC that India has a duty to its consumers and that India will buy from Russia or from wherever else they may wish and choose to do so.
Analysts claim that the reason for global inflation and the fuel crisis in Europe are a result also of the policies of the West against Russia. If the Western imperial powers had not sanctioned Russia, global oil prices would have been stable and fuel prices would have been low. Because of the response of the US and EU to the conflict in Ukraine, Russia has now lowered its fuel prices, which in turn pushed other oil-producing countries to lower their prices to compete with Russia. This has ultimately benefited countries like India, which has used its low-cost Russian crude to give a boost to its economy, surpassing the UK to become the fifth-largest economy in the world, only behind US, China, Japan, and Germany. Low oil prices have helped India cope with inflated US dollar and global prices. Thus, Indian foreign reserves have been less affected than it would have been had India not made a deal with the Russian Federation. Speaking at GlobeSec, Indian Foreign Minister S.J. Shankar said India is not sitting on the fence and it is entitled to make its own decisions when it comes to policy, rather than siding with other countries.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mrs. Anuradha Mitra Chennoi, adjunct professor at the School of International Relations at Jindal Global University in New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Chennoi. Now, how much do you think the response by the U.S. and its allies to the conflict in Ukraine has affected the world so far?
I think this war is really driven by the U.S. and the allies. Ukraine would not have been able to fight back at all and would have collapsed very fast without the support of the huge amount of weapons, the earlier training, strategic suggestions, the intelligence by the US and their allies. Essentially, what I'm saying is there has been a strong element of a proxy war here. Also, of course, the Ukrainian soldiers have put up a great fight. But this would not have been possible without the support of the US and NATO.
Mr. Chennoi, it's interesting to see what's going on in the world right now. The US and its allies are trying their best to corner Russia, but nothing seems to be working. Now, do you think this new move by the US and its allies to put a cap on Russian oil prices will work?
I don't think so, because just look at the US move on cap on oil prices. Basically, it targets the insurance companies. And the insurance companies have been pressured to say that they will not insure the ships which carry Russian oil. But the Russian oil goes through various ways. Countries like, Russia is calibrating its oil prices accordingly. So they've already negotiated a pretty interesting deal with the Chinese, where they're going to give Russian oil at discounted prices of 50%, but guaranteed till December. So that's one source where Russian oil continues to go regardless of price fluctuations. Similarly, India is getting oil at discounted prices. So I don't know how a cap on prices will impact India. And similarly, several countries of the global south. So then today I just saw that they are sending a shipload even to Greece. So it doesn't look like their efforts, which have not worked so far, will work as far as oil is concerned. The world is oil hungry, especially the developing countries, and also for other Russian commodities. So I don't think this is going to really work, and winter is coming. So Europe will have to also rethink, just like Hungary is rethinking, for example, and Bulgaria and some others. But nonetheless, the US wants to have a long war of attrition, of economically decimating Russia. And in the long run, they're going to keep isolating it. So, of course, there will be some impacts, negative impacts on Russia. no matter how much they balance with others. They will be isolated from the overall Western economy.
Last but not least, Mrs. Chinoy, in your assessment, have a cheaper Russian oil bill and in general, India-Russia trade ties helped India surpass the UK economy?
To some extent, yes, but the fact is that India does have an industrial and manufacturing base, which has, you know, it's a long history of Indian economy, which has resulted in this. It's not a one-day or a six-month affair. It is how the Indian economic system has been over so many years, you know, a gradual development. Of course, there's a lot of inequality, but there are also reforms which have helped the economic elite gain a great deal. And in that, oil and also manufacturing and defense production and other production, and the fact that several industries which are moving from China, some of which have come to India. India has also been a beneficiary, as have Vietnam and South Korea. So there have been benefits to that extent, and that's helped all of this together.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Chinoy for being on the program. She is a professor at the School of International Relations. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Martin Jack claims the West's strategy on Ukraine depends on economic sanctions against Russia. Those sanctions aren't working because Russian oil exports to India and China far exceed Western sanctions against Russia. The West still thinks it dominates the world, but China and India prove this is no longer the case. Reuters. India says importing Russian oil part of inflation management. Bloomberg. Russian oil imports now account for 12% of India's total, up from 2% in just a few months.
And that was our episode about Karbala and the sacrifice of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, which unites the people of the Indian subcontinent. And also how India buying oil from Russia affects the foreign policy and economy of this country. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
European countries who take orders from their masters in Washington should be blamed for the current energy crisis across the continent. Unfortunately, European people are being sacrificed by the wrong policies of their leaders. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye had this headline saying Europe must shoulder the blame for the energy crisis. Middle East Eye, penned by Jonathan Cook, wrote, "The same arrogant, self-righteous posturing from the West that fueled the Ukraine war is now plundering Europe into recession." Outraged Western leaders are threatening a price cap on imports of Russian natural gas after Moscow cut supplies to Europe this month, deepening an already dire energy and cost of living crisis. In response, Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned that Europe will freeze this winter unless there is a change of track. In this back and forth, the West keeps stepping up the rhetoric. The Western media has to carry a major share of the blame for these serial failures of diplomacy. Journalists have amplified only too loudly and uncritically what US and European leaders want their publics to believe is going on. But maybe it is time that Europeans heard a little of how things might look to Russian eyes. The West is well practiced in waging economic war on weak states, usually in a futile attempt to topple leaders they don't like or as a softening up exercise before it sends in troops or proxies. Middle East Eye added, worse still, this impulse does not appear to be open to correction, not as things stand. The truth is that NATO and its US ringmaster have no interest in changing. Their purpose is to have a credible bogeyman, one that justifies continuing the massive wealth redistribution from ordinary citizens to an elite of already ultra-rich. A supposed threat to Europe's safety justifies pouring money into the maw of an expanding war machine masquerading as the defense industries, the military, the arms manufacturers, and the ever-growing complex of the surveillance, intelligence, and security industries. Both NATO and a U.S. network of more than 800 military bases around the globe just keep growing. A bogeyman also ensures the Western publics are unified in their fear and hatred of an external enemy, making them readier to defer to their leaders to protect them, and with it, the institutions of power those leaders uphold and the status quo they represent. Anyone suggesting meaningful reform of that system can be rounded on a threat to national security, a traitor, or a fool, as Britain's former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn found out. On a bogeyman distracts Western publics from thinking about deeper and threats, ones that own leaders rather than foreigners are responsible for, such as the climate crisis they not only ignored, but are still fuel through the very military posturing and global confrontations they use to distract people. It is a perfect circle of self-harm. Since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the demise of the Soviet Union, the West has been casting around for a useful bogeyman to replace the Soviet Union, one that supposedly presents an existential threat to Western civilization. Common Dreams website wrote, Europe's energy system is a scam against its own people. Common Dreams website said, amid a growing energy crisis, political leaders across Europe want to divert attention away from their own role in its exacerbation and instead make citizens focus on one only thing, Russia. However, it is far more complex than that. During the recent panel discussion on the energy crisis, Yanis Varoufakis laid out the workings of the European energy market that exists today, one which has long been designed to favor the oligarchy above the people. Varoufakis begins by explaining the Thatcherite model that subsequently extended to the rest of Europe, before outlining the corrupt practice of energy auctioning, followed by the Greek government scam that Ursula von der Leyen wants to implement across the continent, and ended by offering solutions to overhaul this injustice system.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
We'll be right back. It was a massacre that was unprecedented, and it highlighted how private U.S. military contractors felt that they were above the law. 15 years ago, these military contractors shot and killed 17 Iraqis, including 2 children. The massacre, which became known as the Nisour Square Massacre, highlighted what can go wrong when private military contractors are used, especially when it comes to accountability.
We strive for perfection. We try to drive towards the highest standards, but the fog of war and accidents and the bad guys just have to get lucky once.
The U.S. used private military contractors heavily in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Now the new theater of war is Ukraine. Here is an ad for hiring these contractors. Wanted, multilingual former soldiers willing to covertly head into Ukraine for the handsome sum of up to $2,000 per day. Yes, demand is soaring, and there are plenty of people who are signing up. But what are they called? Contractors? Volunteers? Mercenaries? Or paid security workers? Obviously, some are former soldiers with the ability to fight and kill. This leaves plenty of room for mistakes, meaning civilian casualties. Remember when Ukraine's president made this announcement? Zelensky reveals number of foreign volunteers for Ukraine, the first of some 16,000 fighters to have already arrived, the Ukrainian president said. He further added, Ukraine continues to receive weaponry on a daily basis from our partners, from real friends. And the weapons are more and more powerful every day. The very same weapons that are given to these volunteers. So far, the number of so-called volunteers to have joined the Ukrainian armed forces could be as high as 20,000, a figure that could even exceed that. The demographics of these fighters are varied. In all, fighters from Eastern Europe and former Soviet republics constitute the majority of fighters. In terms of Western countries, the greatest number of foreign fighters include the US, UK, Canada, Germany, France, and even some that are coming from Japan. When it comes to the U.S. private military contractors, the one that stands out is Academy, formerly known as Blackwater. Reports have pointed to its involvement in Ukraine. First, reports emerged in July 2021 that Blackwater founder Eric Prince had plans to create a $10 billion private army in Ukraine. His plans included a private army staff by former Ukrainian combat veterans. However, what is not widely reported was that Academy was involved in Ukraine already since the year 2014. Hundreds of these mercenaries were operating in the country's east and south, but the U.S. has denied these claims. But other Western countries are open in their admission of foreign fighters fighting in Ukraine. Take Germany, for example. Germany's Foreign Office tweet is very telling here. Reports on death sentences against foreign nationals serving in Ukraine's armed forces are shocking. As combatants, they are prisoners of war, entitled to special protections under the Geneva Convention. The UK's involvement has been heavy when it comes to foreign fighters. In June, it was reported how the UK has training centers set up for Ukrainian recruits to train soldiers sent by Kiev, including women, for urban combat. The target for the number of people that the UK can train, 10,000 soldiers every 3 months. Whether they are private military contractors, volunteers, or whatever name they are called, they're fueling the flames of war. It should be mentioned that Russia is also complicit in its use of contractors or mercenaries as well, as it has been reported. The extent and the number, however, is not known. Let's not forget, it wasn't too long ago that the armed groups in Syria were getting help from America, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. And a source of training for the armed gangs was the notorious U.S. private security firm formerly known as Blackwater. Security circles have long reported that it was sending mercenaries from Iraq into Syria, something which the U.S. stands accused of until this day. Ukraine is becoming eerily similar to Syria, thanks to the U.S. and its European partners, who are keen to make sure that this war continues, from the massive military aid to manpower in the form of these contractors. Pumping Ukraine with weapons has become the main trend for the U.S., leading the Europeans down the same path. So high the volume of these weapons that Ukrainian illegal arms trafficking has become a terrorist threat at an international level. This is just another outcome of the wrong and deadly U.S. foreign policy, in which many Iraqis witnessed 15 years ago, as was the case in the Nisour Square massacre. conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia, after a truce, has blown up again. About 100 soldiers have died in total. This is the worst fighting between the two since their 2020 war. According to Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, provocations committed by Armenian forces at the border have been averted and all necessary objectives were fulfilled. It blamed Armenia for the flare-up. It is widely reported that this conflict is due to the dispute over Nagorno-Karabakh region, in which two wars have been fought between the former Soviet republics of Armenia and Azerbaijan. A quick history check reveals how ethnic Armenian separatists in Nagorno-Karabakh first broke away from Azerbaijan when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. The war that broke out afterwards claimed the lives of around 30,000 people. Back in 2020, when another war broke out, which lasted 6 weeks, 6,500 lives were lost. The fighting ended with a Russian-brokered ceasefire. Moscow deployed thousands of peacekeepers in the region to successfully mediate to prevent the war from continuing. The question is, what is behind the most recent flare-up? Azerbaijan needs access to bodies of water in order to provide energy resources to the West, which, given its relationship with Iran, Israel and Western entities would prevent that from happening. Azerbaijan's last 2 years of military action against Armenia is to cut and separate the land route between Iran and Armenia and the direct access to Nakhchivan from the southern area of Siunak or Zangezur Corridor, the concept for a transport corridor which, if implemented, would give Azerbaijan unimpeded access to Nakhchivan. Meanwhile, Israel, the U.S., Russia, and Turkey do have a hand either directly or indirectly in this conflict, all for their own political objectives. Israel is a supporter of Azerbaijan, and as such has strengthened its relationship, especially when it comes to military equipment like drones. This to have a front against Iran. Meanwhile, Iran has always had a diplomatic approach to the conflict. During the past war, it was very telling what Iran said, that renewed fighting between its neighbors, Azerbaijan and Armenia, could escalate into a wider regional war. And this is where the U.S. may have motives behind seeing a renewed conflict. One intention may be to draw Russia into this war in order to weaken its capabilities in the Ukraine conflict. And the U.S. certainly does not mind if Iran's borders are destabilized, leaving that task to its watchdog in the region, namely Israel. The U.S., however, is presenting another side to this provocation. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said that Russia may have a hand in this conflict, stirring the pot in order to distract from Russia's most recent losses in Ukraine, according to the U.S. point of view.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his high-ranking diplomatic and economic delegation has visited Uzbekistan on an official visit. The aim of the visit was to expand bilateral ties with Uzbekistan. Iran and Uzbekistan signed a total of 17 memoranda of understanding that the two countries would boost their cooperation in the fields of trade, cargo transit, cultural exchanges, health and custom issues, among others. Another important aim of President Raisi's trip was Iran's further integration into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran has held signing a memorandum of commitments to join the SCO. The announcement was made by Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who is accompanying the delegation on the visit to the city of Samarkand, which is hosting a summit of the SCO. It means that Tehran has now entered a new stage of diverse economic, commercial, transit, energy, and other cooperation with the member states of the regional body. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization was founded by China, Russia, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan in 2001.
Whereas Shanghai Cooperation Organization is about exactly what it says. I mean, it's about countries cooperating in the sphere of economic issues, but also security. If we look, what are the benefits for Iran? Well, I mean, there are a number of benefits within the sphere of economics and security. Hard security. Because, I mean, Iran has been subjected to decades now of economic coercion and threat of military action by US unipolar world, which has been using its institutions to coerce and squeeze Iran.
It's currently the world's biggest regional market, with 8 official members and 3 observer states. Iran and the organization started a formal process for Tehran's accession to the bloc in March. Its membership was later approved by the Iranian administration. Despite the US-led efforts to isolate Iran over the past decades, Tehran's diplomatic weight in regional bodies is not growing. Iran's presence in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization will give it economic and political room to further integrate into the non-Western-led bloc.
This is a possibility for Iran to develop cooperation in such things as economic matters with other countries in the non-Western world. I mean, this is equally true for the large countries such as Russia or China, where, I mean, such an arrangement, I mean, it's beneficial for everyone. It's a reciprocal exchange. It's not a one-way exchange. And so I think in this regard, Iran, with its location and with its resources, is a very useful addition.
Iran has also applied to join BRICS, a group consisting of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. This forum represents 40% of the world's population and 26% of the world's economy. Ultimately, BRICS could become a club of the world's largest energy producers and consumers outside the United States. Iran holds the world's second largest gas reserve, and its membership in BRICS would result in added value for both sides. Iran's potential membership to the BRICS group would be a severe blow to US attempts to isolate Iran. It's believed that Iran's presence in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and its role in the BRICS Plus economic mechanism have both made Iran a partner in international macro decision-making and in the political, security, and economic fields.
I mean, what happens here, it provides possibilities to create meaningful cooperative relationships with countries of the non-Western order. And this is the order that is rising. We can see lately, too, I mean, Iran has not been the only one under pressure, but India as well for its independent position on Ukraine. So, I mean, these Western institutions are just absolutely part of their foreign policy agenda, which is to maintain US hegemony at all costs.
It will also elevate the position of the multilateralist front in the international calculations. Tehran, for a long time, has called for the pro-multilateralism front to establish and promote independent financial, economic, political, and cultural mechanisms in order to make a smooth transition from the current unilateral US-led world order to a multilateral one.
When it comes to Iran, Israel has never refrained from relaying its sentiment, especially when it comes to Iran's civilian nuclear program. It has always maintained that Iran is after weaponizing its nuclear program, and it has gone out of its way to provide the IAEA and the US with fabricated evidence to prove its false claim. But Israel may have stepped too far in its latest claim against Iran and the JCPOA sanctions removal talks. The head of Israel's spy agency, Mossad, said the revival of a nuclear deal with world powers will not give Iran immunity from Israeli operations. This is a fully loaded statement, which, if taken a look at closely, actually proves that Israel has executed destructive and lethal acts against Iran, including sabotaging its nuclear program, destroying Iran's nuclear facilities, and assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, to name a few. David Bernia, in his first speech since becoming Mossad's chief, has said, "We won't take part in this charade. Even if a deal is signed, it will not provide immunity from Mossad operations." Even though Israel has never admitted to acting against Iran, this can be interpreted that the opposite is true. Iran's response to these statements were to the point, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said we do not expect a terrorist regime anything other than terrorist actions. Some Israeli acts of terrorism against Iran include the assassination of four nuclear scientists and damaging Iran's nuclear facility in Karaj. Now, the question is, will the international community react to this, or will it wait until Israel commits another act of violence or terrorism against Iran?
Israel is a rogue nation. It is a terrorist nation. It will not adhere to international law. It will not respect international law. The fact that it has been working against Iran, assassinating scientists and other means against Iran, just indicates that it is a rogue nation, that if the JCPOA should be resurrected, Israel will not respect Iran's borders as it has not in the past. We have to remember that Israel has been has violated international law repeatedly, not only in Palestine, Iran, but Syria and Lebanon. Israel has no regard for international law, has no regard for human rights. So these statements by the Mossad chief are just consistent with Israel's criminal activities.
Talks between Iran and the world powers on its civilian nuclear program have progressed to the point where the impasse may have been resolved towards reaching a solution. That is one of the reasons Israel has reacted by publicly stating it would not stop from executing acts against Iran. And its moves in that regard have been in overdrive. On the surface, Israeli moves to undermine the deal appears to have worked. Israel announced that it does not believe that Iran and world powers will return to their nuclear deal before the November midterm elections. And even though it looked like a deal was on the horizon, the IAEA repeated its old accusations of wanting an explanation on traces of uranium. A quarterly report by the nuclear watchdog on Iran's compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, accused Iran to have continued enrichment beyond limits in the agreement, even though Iran has demonstrated maximum transparency. But these negative reports on Iran may be political in nature. The U.S. administration and President Joe Biden may not want to jeopardize the chances for his party winning the midterm elections. Israel's Prime Minister Yair Lapid is also dealing with elections in Israel, and a deal may ruin his prospects. For now, the JCPOA survival talks has slipped back into the intensive care unit, and its chances for success appear dim.
Israel is certainly overstepping its bounds. It has no right to say that it's going to assault another nation, that it's going to ignore an agreement that, or it's going to violate an agreement that it isn't a party to, that it is trying to sabotage that agreement, which hasn't even been made yet. It is, as I mentioned before, Israel is a rogue nation, doesn't respect international law. Now, the JCPOA signed a number of years ago between European nations, the United States, and Russia, and it was the United States that violated it. The Israeli government has been opposed to it from the start and continues to be opposed to it. We have to remember, Israel is a nuclear-armed nation. It and the United States have no right to say what other countries will or will not have nuclear weapons. Now, I personally believe that the fewer nuclear weapons there are in the world, the better it is. But if Iran is being threatened by two nuclear-armed countries, it must defend itself and defend its people. But Israel, to get back to your point, is certainly overstepping its bounds. It is certainly fomenting problems within the Middle East when there don't need to be these particular problems. But this is typical of the behaviors of a terrorist nation, and that is what Israel is. It does certainly threaten its own so-called security by threatening basically war against another powerful nation. So it is doing itself no favors, but to be protected by the United States in all things, so it continues with its crimes and its threatened crimes throughout the Middle East.
a diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The death of Queen Elizabeth has raised much discussion about independence of Commonwealth realms. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the first part. The death of Queen Elizabeth, the UK's longest reigning monarch for 7 decades, has reignited debates in many of the 15 British Commonwealth realms on whether it is time to replace the British monarch with an elected head of state, which puts the long-term existence of the Commonwealth into question, analysts said, citing growing calls to completely get rid of the remnants of the colonial era and embrace full independence and the decline of Britain's strength. With the Queen's demise, 73-year-old Charles ascended to the British throne and was proclaimed King at St. James Palace in London. He was also pronounced head of state in 14 other Commonwealth realms, including Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and some island nations in the Caribbean and South Pacific. King Charles was proclaimed at a time when Britain faces multiple challenges, including a new government led by Prime Minister Liz Truss, who, as Conservative Party leader, inherits a huge mess she needs to tackle. From an ailing economy to the cost of living crisis and growing voices in Scotland and Northern Ireland who desire to leave the UK. Analysts noted that Commonwealth realms are at a crossroads. After the Queen's death, many within the realms have revisited the thought of leaving. Choi Hojingjian, director of the Department of European Studies at the China Institute of International Studies, told the Global Times recently. In addition to the UK, the 14 Commonwealth realms are Antigua and Barbuda, Australia, the Bahamas, Belize, Canada, Grenada, Jamaica, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, St. Kitts and Nevis, St. Lucia, St. Vincent and Grenadines, Solomon Islands and Tuvalu. The king's role as monarch of these countries is generally symbolic and he will not be directly involved in governing, as the British monarch is a head of the state, not head of government. While commemorating Queen Elizabeth, Republican debates have been pushed to the fore in many of the Commonwealth realms. The Guardian reported that in the hours after Queen's death was announced, Republican debate was dramatically re-enlivened, and the Australian Greens leader Adam Bent tweeted that Australia must move forward, we need to become a republic. Reuters reported recently that New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said no immediate steps will be taken to achieve unification, but the nation may eventually become a republic. I've never sensed the urgency. There is so many challenges we face. This is a large, significant debate. Don't think it's one that would or should occur quickly, Ardern told reporters, adding, I do believe that is where New Zealand will head in time. I believe it's likely to occur in my lifetime, but I don't see it as a short-term measure or anything that is on the agenda anytime soon, she said. Campaigns for independence from the British monarchy have been underway in Australia and New Zealand for years. The Queen's death means the end of an era, with more people in Australia and other Commonwealth realms questioning the legitimacy and necessity of a monarch. Cheng Hong, president of the Chinese Association of Australian Studies and director of the Australian Studies Centre at East China Normal University, told the Global Times. Other Commonwealth realms, especially island nations in South Pacific and Caribbean that have suffered colonial rule, may be striving to divorce with the Commonwealth and rid themselves of the scars left by the British colonialists, analysts said. Just after Charles was proclaimed king recently, Antigua and Barbuda Prime Minister Gaston Browne told ITV News that the Caribbean country will hold a referendum on transitioning to a republic and removing King Charles as head of state within the next 3 years. Antigua and Barbuda used to be a British colony. It gained independence from the UK in 1981, but remained as one of the 15 countries where the British monarch is head of state. However, observers also said that the breakaway process from the Commonwealth will not happen overnight. There are uncertainties in the referendum process in some countries, as the UK has taken the Queen's death as an opportunity to continue the influence of the monarchy while emphasizing a sense of closeness and identity. From Barbados and Jamaica to Belize, many Caribbean countries' willingness to leave the Commonwealth shows their pursuit of political independence and modern development. The British monarchy is a historical remnant of a colonial era, and it will face more challenges in the modern world. Zhu Zhuwei, an expert on Latin American studies at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, told the Global Times. The divorce trend is inevitable, as the people in these countries are fighting to defend their dignity and seeking full decolonization. After declaring independence, Caribbean nations have developed stronger relations with the US, China, and other countries. This is also an impetus for these countries to seek more political independence. Coy, expert from SCIS, noted that people from former colonial countries see colonialism as a sin that harms local residents and sabotages their cultures, and most resent it. However, some elites in these countries maintain close bonds with the UK, as their interests are closely aligned. But the landscape is changing with the decline in the UK's strength, Coy noted. The UK no longer has that much to offer to these countries, while people's resentment toward colonialism is rising, as the concept itself is in conflict with the world's general trend of democratic countries. Moreover, since the UK is at the core of the Commonwealth realms, if it fails to deliver any actual benefits to others, either politically or economically, the realms may consider becoming a republic and even discuss leaving the Commonwealth altogether. Seeing the British Empire gradually reduced to a blind follower of the US in international politics, and its domestic politics becoming fragmented and divided, Commonwealth realms must consider what they can get from the system. Time wrote, like many of Britain's former colonies, Ireland has had a complicated relationship with both Britain and its monarchy, one uniquely shaped by a geographical proximity that created intimate but not necessarily friendly ties, both economically and culturally. The death of Queen Elizabeth raised much discussion about the British monarchy's relationship with its former colonies. In the Republic of Ireland, which gained its independence in 1921, the response was respectful and somewhat muted, consistent with complex history. Ireland endured 8 centuries of political and military intervention by its neighbors.